Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 12th, 2010. If, like me, you already bought your holiday plane tickets, you will not want to hear our first story today. But listen, anyway, we'll have a look at the airfare riddle, and it will make you mad. And what if I told you there was a surefire way to determine the size of your future nest egg? Just answer a few word problems.
There were 10,000 people in a room. 1% of them left.
How many of them left? Well, if you got the right answer, you may be one step closer to a rich retirement. But if you need to brush up on your arithmetic, I'd suggest you sit in on a class where they're teaching kids a whole lot more than the three R's.
Saving is easy when we make it a what?
A habit.
Habit.
Those stories and a whole lot more coming up on Marketplace Money. But first, there is a phrase one of our producers likes to bandy about this time of year. It's not cool to be a jive turkey this close to Thanksgiving. Agreed. But that's exactly what some travel companies seem to think we are, a bunch of turkeys. Because the closer we get to the holiday season, the higher airfares go, and we pay them. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us, timing isn't the only thing that we do wrong when it comes to picking a holiday flight.
Who hasn't been there? You agonize over when to buy an airline ticket. And then finally you pull the trigger and prices plummet online. In 2002, that happened to Oren Etzioni.
I was on an airplane on the way to my brother's wedding, and I asked people seated next to me, how much did you pay for your ticket? And it turned out that they bought later than me and paid less.
The folks at the airline had just messed with the wrong guy. Etzioni is a computer science professor at the University of Washington.
And I was actually somewhat incensed. And I started thinking about, can we use computer methods, algorithms, to figure out when's the right time to buy your ticket?
He didn't realize it, but Etzioni was declaring war against an army of airline analysts, guys like Billy Goldberg.
It was pretty satisfying when you would overbook a flight just right.
Bill Goldberg's not a monster. He's actually an old friend of mine. But right out of college, he worked at a major U.S. airline, and his job was to milk every passenger for as much money as possible.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you had a customer who was willing to pay $1,000 for a seat, let's say, and you knew that from historical data, you didn't want to sell it to them for $800. You didn't want to sell it to them for even $900. You wanted to squeeze out every last penny you could until you hit the breaking point.
And guys like Bill had some high-powered help, rooms full of math wizards like E. Andrew Boyd. Until last year, Boyd was the chief scientist at a company you've probably never heard of, called PROS. It creates computerized pricing systems for U.S. airlines. These algorithms are complex, and Boyd says trying to game one on your own can lead to trouble.
Oh boy, let me count the ways.
Boyd's brain trust created computer models to separate airline customers into different buckets.
One of them was the frequent flyer bucket.
Bill Goldberg.
One of them was what we call the Y travelers, the business travelers who would pay a lot of money.
There were buckets for grandmas headed to Florida and students on spring break. The computers modeled their behavior and set prices. And the entire point is to make sure that a businessman whose company will pay full fare never gets the chance to buy a ticket priced for a grandma. And these algorithms can create wild price swings. Imagine for a second that a high school band teacher goes online at 3 a.m. and books 30 cheap seats from New York to Pittsburgh. That freaks out the airline's computer system. And the computer responds to the spike in demand by jacking up prices on the flight. Those higher prices drive passengers to other airlines. And that sets off their own computer pricing systems. Soon, you get a wave of higher prices on flights from New York to Pittsburgh rolling across the board. But the demand doesn't really exist, and then prices fall. To the average observer, these kinds of price swings look choppy, even chaotic. But Oren Etzioni thinks he's cracked the code.
We played with different data mining methods, and we found the question of to buy or not to buy, should I buy now or should I wait, was actually one that we could answer with pretty good accuracy.
Etzioni's program will not only find the lowest fare, it will also tell you if it makes sense to wait before you purchase a ticket. And if you wait, it will monitor the flight and email you when prices drop. Microsoft bought the company for more than $100 million and rolled it into Bing's travel search engine. So now, if you're in the market for an airline ticket, you can fight the airline's pricing algorithms with some math expertise of your own. I checked it out, and I'm still waiting to hear back on a ski trip to Utah. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
And Steve has one more tip for anyone booking a flight. Many airlines offer refunds on your fare if the prices drop after you buy. And while you might not have time to track ticket prices all day long, there is a website that will do it for you for free. It's called yapta.com, and we've got a link at marketplace.org. The gold bugs are out in force these days. Folks who've decided they want a little or a lot of the shiny, precious metal in their portfolios or sitting in a safe at home. Gold passed $1,400 an ounce this week. The price is up more than 20% so far this year, prompting something of a gold fever on international markets. But will that fever break? From London, our Gold Star correspondent Stephen Beard reports.
Buying gold is what investors do when they lose faith in the financial system. And that's why Ian Dunbar took the plunge. A 73-year-old retired doctor from Kent, he got interested in the yellow metal after reading about widespread cocaine use by financial traders.
I think that the judgment of the traders has been severely compromised by cocaine abuse. And that lies at the root of a lot of the problems that we're facing today in the financial world.
Dunbar believes the great debt bubble was partly inflated by traders high on cocaine. That may seem an eccentric view, but it led Dunbar to invest some 10% of his wealth in gold bullion, and so far he's glad he did.
I mean, my holding has been increasing at the rate of 40% a year for several years. That's rather better than a savings account.
69-year-old Ray Hill, a retired computer consultant in Scotland, is another gold bug.
I am not someone who claims any expertise at all in the business of investing.
But he was worried about central banks in the US and Europe printing more money and in the process debauching their currencies. He was anxious to protect the value of his cash savings.
I'd rather put it all in a sock and hide it under the bed. If only that worked. Gold is one of the few areas where that actually does seem to work.
Ray Hill has now put about 20% of his savings, some $70,000, in gold bullion, using a company that's bringing bullion ownership to a wider investing public. BullionVault.com, based here in the West End of London, hit on a formula for cutting the cost of gold ownership. The cheapest way to buy gold, the way the professionals do it, is in so-called good delivery bars, but they weigh 400 ounces each and are currently worth about $500,000. This company, says founder Paul Tustain, lets people buy over the internet part of a bar.
We buy the bars, we have them shipped to the vaults in London, in Zurich and in New York, and then we use the internet to distribute as little or as much of those bars as people want.
Once installed, the gold never moves from the vault. Only the ownership changes. The bullion just sits there. Unlike a share or a bond or real estate, it's not generating any income. So think very carefully before getting into gold, says Tustain.
It is the wrong thing to do if you've got an environment where you strongly believe in economic growth. If you think there's going to be economic growth, participate in it and buy shares or other instruments.
Or, says the company's research director, Adrian Ash, leave your cash in the bank if you're getting a good return. But the chances are you're not.
You currently earn less than zero on cash in the bank. That's true in the States, it's true across Europe, it's true in Japan, has been true in Japan now for well over 12 years.
So in comparison with cash, shares, bonds and real estate, gold has put in a dazzling performance. But the yellow metal doesn't always glitter. After reaching a peak at the end of the 1970s, it slumped and slid and stagnated for the next 20 years. How do we know we're not on the brink of another golden crash?
I don't think we are anywhere near the top of this market because I don't see any sign of policy anywhere in the Western world being anything else than trashing their own currencies.
Gold investors will hope he's right, but most should pray he's wrong. It would mean low growth, high inflation and unemployment. What's good for the gold bugs is bad for the rest of us. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace Money.
On last week's show, we had a conversation about what it's like to be part of the sandwich generation. caring financially for children and aging parents at the same time. This week, a follow-up question. If family finances are being drawn down to help with costs for grandma and grandpa, what happens to the idea of inheritance? That question got commentator and New York Times wealth columnist Paul Sullivan thinking about what to leave behind.
Most people hear the word inheritance and think about money. I don't. It's the least of my worries when it comes to my daughter. She just had her first birthday in August. The money part was pretty straightforward. We contacted an attorney. We looped in our financial advisor. Most importantly, we picked a guardian. It wasn't cheap, and it took a lot of time to do. But that was easy compared to what lies ahead. The crucial part of our daughter's inheritance is what we teach her about making her way in the world. We live in Fairfield County, Connecticut. It's a very nice place, but it's not normal. Many children our daughter plays with are from families whose wealth is measured in the tens of millions, if not billions of dollars. There are tremendous advantages to this, like a tax base that funds great schools. Of course, I want our daughter to know she is fortunate to have these unique opportunities. But this will be a challenge. Here, an upper-middle-class kid looks poor compared to a billionaire's child. For my wife, it's important to leave our daughter with a broader view of success. The schools around us send scores of kids to Ivy League universities every year. Maybe our daughter will go to one of them, but this only counts as success if it's what she wants to do. So far, she loves to eat. We joke that she might become a chef or a food critic. Either would be great, as long as it's what she wants to do. That's why I believe it's absurd for all but the richest families to get wrapped up in the amount of money they will leave their children. First, that fortune could disappear. Think of the people whose wealth was tied up in Lehman Brothers. Worse, waiting for it can leave heirs overly dependent on their parents well into adulthood. What matters to us is that our daughter inherits a sense of independence and a sophisticated view of the world. This is far more important than money.
Paul Sullivan writes the Wealth Matters column for the New York Times. We have a link to their special section on the Sandwich Generation at marketplace.org. One thing everyone can and should bestow upon their kids? Early lessons in how to manage money.
Get in the habit.
Get in the habit.
Like Sammy Rabbit.
Like Sammy Rabbit.
Saving money.
Saving money.
All the time.
All the time.
A kindergarten class on finance and money wisdom from the head of the FDIC. Coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. 1 year ago, we were in Portland, Oregon, doing our show live, on stage, an entire hour about kids and money. So we thought we'd spend some time on that topic again today. First up, Sheila Bair, head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. We spoke with her a few weeks ago about the nation's banks, and we also took the opportunity to talk to her about financial literacy. After all, she wrote two children's books about money. I asked her when you should start the talk.
Well, I think they should start very early. I mean, our kids started taking an interest in money when they were three. I mean, I think, you know, they like to, initially they like to play with the pennies and count them and stack them and things like that. And then later they start understanding the value money symbolizes. So I think, you know, money's a great way to learn math. You just start counting, you know, 100 pennies and a dollar. And so, yeah, I think it's important to tap into that natural interest as early as possible.
But I think what a lot of parents tell us is that they're hesitant to do that because they're not sure that they have enough education.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to write picture books for children, because the parents read the picture books with their kids. And so the parents maybe can pick up some information,
right,
too, as they're reading the book with their child. And So I think that's right. There is definitely a financial education need for the adult population as well. The FDIC has something called Money Smart. It's a very widely used financial education curriculum. You can get information online about it from our website. And I think that is a very good resource for adults who would like to learn more about managing their personal finances.
It seems like financial literacy is becoming a bit of a buzzword these days, a buzz phrase, but still there is no national requirement for economics or personal finance curriculum in high school or middle school. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of that is just the way our school system is structured in this country. It's localized, so it's very difficult to have standards that applying across the board. I hate to say that, but I think one way to get more of this into the schools is to have, you know, some of the tests that unfortunately we find we need to rely on these days, and I think there are reasons for that. But making sure the test for financial knowledge, I think that's another incentive for schools to get that kind of content into the basic curriculum.
Your parents were children of the Great Depression.
They were. Yeah.
How do you think that shaped what you learned about money as a kid?
Well, I think it made me conservative. I think, you know, and very careful. My mother grew up on a farm in the wake of the Great Depression and then suffered through the Dust Bowl. And so she, you know, she knows about how important it is to conserve and save. Those are certainly strong values that she instilled into for me and my sister. It's harder these days to teach kids those kinds of lessons. And I guess the unfortunate part of this now is this recession has brought home to people what economic hardship means, and far too many people are facing it right now.
What did you learn about money in school?
Nothing,
yeah,
really.
I mean,
I had home ec. Remember home ec?
Exactly, yeah. That's...
So, you know, actually, I shouldn't say nothing because, you know, I learned how to make a dress and bake a cake, but I also learned how to, you know, the basics of a family budget. So I think those were, you know, I'm glad that I learned how to bake a cake and sew a dress, too. But I think, you know, yeah, the basics of family budgeting were important. And, of course, back then it was much simpler. It was really more about, you know, your grocery budget and things like that. Now it's about 401ks and 529s and deposit insurance limits and all those kinds of things.
I guess I would end by just asking for, you know, both as the chair of the FDIC and as a mom, really the number one piece of advice that you would have for parents in teaching their kids about money.
Well, I think... I'm going to have two answers to that. One is, I think, understanding risk. They need to understand risk so that, you know, you have to put your money somewhere, but understanding risk and understanding what your risk tolerance are and that there are risks out there, I think, is very important. And then also, I think, a message of thrift and savings. And there needs to be balance between consumption and saving. And that sometimes it's better if you want something to wait and save for it and make sure you really want it before you buy it. It'll mean more to you, and that you also might find during that waiting period that you didn't really want it after all. And so I think those are, you know, probably the most important fundamental ideas that that parents should impart to their kids.
FDIC Chairwoman Sheila Bair speaking with us from her office in Washington. So as she mentioned, her kids started taking an interest in money when they were three. Could be they take after their mom. But advocates for financial education say pretty much no age is too young to start teaching kids about money. In New Jersey, education officials are thinking about making financial literacy classes mandatory starting in kindergarten. We wondered what that kind of curriculum might look and sound like.
Good morning, boys and girls!
Good morning!
Good morning, boys and girls!
Good morning!
Well, that's what it sounded like one morning last month at Kip Raisis Academy in East Los Angeles. About 40 kids, kindergartners and second graders, crowded into one small classroom to hear about Sammy the Rabbit, who makes saving a habit. He's the creation of author and guest speaker Sam Renick.
I discovered a few years ago that there's a big problem, is that kids and their parents are not saving money. Everybody say saving.
Saving.
Money.
Money.
Helps.
Helps.
Us.
Us.
The principal at Kip Raisis, Amber Young, launched the public charter school's new money education program earlier this year.
I think if you start instilling the importance of saving beginning at that age, it just becomes a part of who they are and how they think. So, I mean, we're not really getting into detailed concepts quite yet about budgeting, but just sort of, you know, pennies piling up, what you can do with that over time. That's a concept that our students can really grasp.
Now go like this. Saving?
Saving
is a great?
Is a great?
Great?
Great.
Habit?
Habit.
Sammy Rabbit?
Sammy Rabbit.
Everybody give yourselves a little round of applause. All right, here we go. Chapter 2. Sammy, a habit is a choice we repeat again, again, and again. Saving is easy when we make it a habit. When is saving easy? When we make it a what?
A habit.
Habit.
The something idea for focusing on financial education came from a chance meeting at a local farmer's market about a year ago. Principal Young was introduced to Jesse Torres, the CEO of East LA's Pan American Bank. Torres is on a mission to get more of the city's unbanked population, especially Latino families, to use banks instead of the mattress.
For years, we had tried to bring financial literacy to the adults. And there is a lot of truth to the notion that you can't teach an old dog a new trick. What we decided to do was focus on the kids. And so our approach has been to go out to the communities that we serve and focus on the kids at the youngest age, at the pre-K, and working all the way up through high school.
So Pan American Bank opens bank accounts for the kids, starts them off with a $5 deposit, gives them tours of the vault, and then follows up by helping pay for financial literacy training like the Sammy Rabbit class.
The thought is to get them into that mindset of becoming savers, of setting up goals in their minds, whether that goal is college education, whether it's saving for a home, for a car, whatever it might be, a bicycle.
You can do it.
You can do it.
Now let's get to it.
Now let's get to it.
From every dollar?
From every dollar?
Save a dime.
Save a dime.
All right, everybody clap. Everybody sing. Get in the habit. Like Sammy. Saving money. All the time.
Author Sam Renick has an actual sidekick, a costumed Sammy Rabbit who draws squeals from the kids when he appears. Renick has taken the saving message to 35 states and read to more than a quarter of a million kids. He says the younger, the better.
I've had principals share with me, if you don't reach kids early, by the time they get to middle school, it's too late. Everything is up for grabs there. So you want all of their thinking, education-wise, money-wise, values-wise, cemented, because they're going to be tested in middle school.
They'll be tested in middle school and beyond by a barrage of messages about spending, which is why Principal Young says the school will follow up Sammy's saving lesson with classes about needs versus wants. So what did the kids learn from Sam the Money Man, as Renick calls himself?
What's your name?
Josiah.
And how old are you?
Five.
Five, you're in kindergarten. What did you learn today?
Don't waste your money.
Don't waste your money, that's a good one. Okay, how about you? What's your name? How old are you?
My name is Hannah, and I'm seven.
And you're seven, and what did you learn today?
I learned that you just, like, save stuff.
Right. So who here remembers how much out of every dollar you should save? What did Sammy say? What's your name?
Angel Carrasco. I'm 7 years old.
So how much out of every dollar are you supposed to save?
One dime.
One dime. That's right. Does that sound easy or hard?
Easy.
Is that something you'll be able to do? Are you doing it already?
Yes, I have $100. I have $100 in my bank account.
$100?
Mom, that's a lot.
That is a lot of money. How did you do that?
Because I started saving since I was 5 years old. And my brother's barely started saving a year ago.
Good for you. So Sammy would be very impressed with you.
As would, frankly, most of us.
All right, everybody, give Sammy a big round of applause. Sammy, wave goodbye to everybody. You guys have a great day. Remember, Sammy says save your money and make lots of big dreams come true. All right, have a wonderful day.
We've got photos online at marketplace.org, plus a video of the kids singing along with Sammy Rabbit, which I promise will not play over and over in your head for days on end.
Save
the rabbit!
Save
the money!
Save money!
All the time!
Outside. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time to take a few of your questions. And with us this week is our good friend Chris Farrell, our economics editor. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess, and it's great to be here.
So we've been talking about kids and money. Of course,
sure.
A year ago, we did an entire show dedicated to this. But let me ask you what I think is a key question for a lot of parents, which is, at what age do you start having this conversation? At what age do you start teaching this whole money thing? And I know you went through it twice. So
I went through it twice. And Tess, I'm laughing because I think every parent starts the lesson at a horrible moment. You have a young child and you're at Walmart or Target or the grocery store. And you say, that's too expensive, or our family doesn't buy things like that. And then all of a sudden, there is a temper tantrum. There is a complete meltdown. And all you're trying to do is give a money lesson. But, you know, what I really think children learn from their parents is what their parents do. If you are borrowing a lot and you're stressed out about debt all the time, you know what your kids are going to pick up? That you borrow a lot.
Yeah.
For my children, for both of them, you know, we would have the ongoing conversations and we had an allowance and that kind of a thing. But I really think the shift in money conversation came when they both got jobs in high school because then they're earning some money.
Right.
It becomes a real conversation as opposed to an abstract, and it's less about the bank of dad or the bank of mom.
But, you know, on that point, I mean, Chris, obviously, you know, you've been dealing with this subject for most of your adult life.
Yes.
It's not something that's uncomfortable for you. But, I think for a lot of parents, it is. You know, not only do they not know how to teach their kids about money, but, you know, they're not even sure that they're doing things right.
That's right. But I do think you can still talk about the major issues. And what are they? They're spending, they're saving, and then debt. You know, I think that's a conversation that you can have on a relaxed basis over a longer period of time.
All right. Advice from the man, the myth, the legend, and the dad, Chris Farrell. All right, let's head to the phones. Libby is with us from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Libby.
Hello.
What do you do up there in Seattle?
I work in environmental consulting.
That sounds like a very scientific pursuit.
It is, yes. My background is actually in climate change and geology, so that's kind of what I focused on when I was in school.
So, wow. So yeah. you were always a bit of a science nut?
Yeah, kind of nerdy. It's okay. I take full responsibility for it.
So how can we help you out today?
Well, I am thinking about going back. So I have my master's in geology, and I'm thinking about going back and getting my master's in teaching.
Okay.
You haven't had enough school?
Yeah, right. I kind of tend to be a perpetual student, and I realized, you know, one of my main things that I really enjoy is talking and teaching science. So thought that might be a good place to start, right?
What age group are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about middle schoolers. That's kind of where earth science is.
That's where they need it.
Yes, they do. I'm also a little nervous because it's middle schoolers, but...
Yeah, but I think that's particularly awesome because I think we need more female teachers to get the girls excited about going into science.
That is actually one big goal that I have, is to get girls jazzed about science because it's...
Fantastic.
You know, something we should do.
Just had to say, I have a friend who's a middle school teacher and she loves it. It's a wonderful age group. You know, they're becoming people that talk back and they have ideas. And
so, Chris, you like it when people talk back to you?
Yes, I do. Well, look at our relationship. I mean, come on, Tess. You know, let's, you know.
Well, so I'm guessing that if you are looking at going back to school, you may have some questions about financing that effort.
It's true.
Yeah.
I don't have any debt at this point, and I'm a little bit nervous about how to finance it, and also just for me, taking on debt is not something that right now, it's a mental block for me right now.
Well, what are some of your options? I mean, do you have a savings account?
I do have enough money in my savings account to pay for a couple of quarters of the program, so definitely not the whole program.
Right. Well, and I mean, if you were to use your savings to go toward your education, would that wipe out, say, an emergency fund?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, like, I have my emergency fund is what my savings is.
Yeah, right. Well, and I think that we would probably want you to keep some sort of emergency fund around.
Yeah. How much money are we talking about?
It's actually not that bad as far as I can tell. It'd probably be about $16,000 to $18,000 for the two-year program.
A $16,000 to $18,000 investment to do something that you really want to do, I just don't think is that big of an impediment. And you could perhaps pay for a little bit keep, as Tess was saying, some emergency savings.
Right.
And there's also something to pursue, which is if you're willing to teach in a low-income neighborhood.
Okay.
There's actually a lot of loan forgiveness programs out there.
Uh-huh.
And the loan forgiveness ranges from, I think it's around $5,000 to $17,000, depending on the type of loan. There's a wonderful resource. If you go to the American Federation of Teachers,
okay,
they have it, and you click on your state. And then they have online with links to all the various programs, including a program by the state of Washington.
Okay.
Typically, and I'm sort of doing a little, condensing, because as you know, if you've already had a master's, you know that the rules are always more complicated than what we can relay. But typically, it's like a five-year commitment.
Does that make you feel a little bit more comfortable about maybe taking on some debt for this?
It actually does.
So when would you be starting school?
Next June, actually. So pretty soon.
So would you quit your job?
Yeah, I'm going to hopefully work while I'm going to school. The program is set up so that I can work part or full time while I'm going to school.
Well, that's even better.
Sounds ideal, doesn't it?
I was going to say, am I getting carried away here, or are we thinking we're earning an income,
exactly,
we're tapping a little bit in the savings, but we're not eliminating the savings, and we're not borrowing this even the full amount of money. We're just, mm-hmm, only going to be borrowing a little bit. Boy, that seems pretty good to me.
I
you
like
got
that.
The green
Thank
light
you.
Here.
Yeah, sounds good. I feel much better now.
All right. Well, good luck with the program, and
Thank
good
you.
Luck with those kids.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Libby.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back later in the show to take a few more of your questions. In the meantime, stay tuned. And if you have a question yourself, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Send us a note through the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Saving money for the future can be a crapshoot because you never know how much is enough. But if you're a parent, here's one figure you can take to the bank: the cost to raise a kid.
$222,000. And not to scare you even further, but that does not include any savings for college.
Oh. Okay, Nancy can need some oxygen.
Planning for a baby coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Talk a lot about how money figures into relationships. First, you got to address it, then you got to figure out what to do with it. And of course, each partner is going to bring different money strengths and weaknesses to the table. But a study published this week shows that at least one half of the couple better know their math. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from New York.
What does it take to acquire family wealth? Brain power, but especially good arithmetic, according to a new study from the Rand Corporation. Rand economist Jim Smith says couples were asked three math questions, pretty simple ones like...
There were 10,000 people in a room. 1% of them did something, left. And the question would be, how many people left the room?
If you answered 100, you're right. But don't get too excited. Smith would call you average.
Most people get one out of the three questions correct.
Those incorrect answers, they translated into a smaller nest egg. Couples who got all three questions right averaged $1.7 million of family wealth. Couples who got all of them wrong, they'd tucked away only $200,000. Smith says what mattered most was the numerical prowess of the husband.
Inside the family, when they say, okay, who's calling the shots, who's making the financial decisions, there is a male bias. It's much more likely to be the husband than the wife.
The study didn't consider same-sex couples, and respondents were all over 50. Financial planner Susan John says among her younger clients, male domination of the family's savings has begun to fade.
You see much more shared decision-making and much more discussion, actually, around finances, which used to be another of the great taboo subjects.
John says that's progress. But if you believe the Rand study, you might want to skip the chit-chat and turn the financial reins over to the family math whiz. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace Money.
We're back with Chris Farrell to take more of your questions. And Dana is on the line from Gainesville, Florida. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
And how do you listen to the show?
I listen to the show on WUFT-FM in Gainesville.
And what do you do there?
I am a grad student at the University of Florida.
At the University of Florida, all right. So are you doing anything to put yourself through school?
I do work. I actually, this will sound funny, I work at a public radio station.
You do?
I do. I have a classical music show.
Well, as a classical pianist, I can fully support that effort. Are you a musician yourself?
I'm not a musician. I am more of an aficionado and record collector.
All right. How many albums are hanging around your house?
Oh, wow. It's a shocking, shocking number of thousands. Not albums,
whoa,
actually. To tell you the truth, it's CDs. I am not one of these people who collects a lot of vinyl. There would be not enough room in my home for that.
Who is your favorite composer?
Well, I tell you what. I like Johann Sebastian Bach the best.
Oh, jeez.
Whoa, what? What's wrong with Bach?
No, it's really funny because I actually started studying piano again after doing it as a kid. I started about 5 years ago, and my teacher, her favorite composer is Bach, and mine is Chopin.
Okay.
I love playing Chopin.
Mine is Bach.
Well,
I gotta go with
Bach. So I'm totally outnumbered here.
Chopin is wonderful also. I'm not going to, you know, challenge your preference for Chopin.
Okay.
A public radio feud over classical music.
Yes. So this will be another student loan question?
Actually, it is not a student loan question. It's a more of a credit card question. It goes sort of like this. I received a statement in the mail a few weeks ago that kind of took me by surprise because I don't have any credit cards. It's for about $1,400. I thought, uh-oh, maybe someone has stolen my identity. It has my name on it, has my correct address. And okay. I called them up, and it was related to a credit card that I used to have a long time ago. I paid them off through a consumer credit counseling agency. I was
sure,
sort of not in as good a financial shape. And there was one, it turns out, that had sort of fallen through the cracks. Unfortunately, I'm not proud to say, this credit card was charged off, you know, probably about 6.5, almost 7 years ago.
Dana, have you checked your credit reports?
I haven't.
Yeah, no, I mean, Chris, wouldn't you agree that would probably be a first step to see if this collection is on those?
That's exactly right. It's extremely important. The first thing you want to do is get a hold of your credit reports and see who really owns the debt. The other thing you need to do is find out about the statute of limitations in your state.
Okay.
I believe in Florida is 5 years, but there's a really wonderful resource, creditcards.com.
Okay.
And they have a map in the United States, and you just click on your state.
Okay. Now, this brings me to another point that when I was speaking to this gentleman on the phone, he was polite enough, but he told me that they were contacting me because some new credit card laws allowed them to get in touch with me, even though I had told them not to.
No. There is no new credit card law that basically says, collectors, you can go after people at any expense or cost to them.
Yeah. The real dynamic here is a lot of people have defaulted on their debts. And with technology, it costs so little to buy a whole portfolio of defaulted debts. And then you start making your phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you know, one of the sort of like tricks of the trade is, let's say you just sent in a couple of dollars. Well, then all of a sudden the whole statute of limitations kicks in again.
Yep.
Yeah, and it reads
so there's all kinds of stuff. There's a real imbalance of knowledge. I mean, people should be paying their debts. So, you know, don't get me wrong on that. But I think this is one of the most troublesome areas in our economy.
Well, and I think that, you know, citing the credit card law, everybody knows that there is a new credit card law, but they don't necessarily know what's in it. So it's a very easy thing to cite and say, hey, you know, you've heard about this, and this is why we're coming after you.
Well, that's very good advice. I appreciate it. I was just, you know, received a letter that kind of disturbed me, and I wasn't sure the best course to take.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you've got a question, let us know about it. Send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Well, I knew when the dogs started barking that our mail lady was here with the latest correspondence from you. Our mail lady and senior producer, Deb Clark, is with us. Did everyone write to say how much they loved us this week?
Oh, of course. No, but I do have one word for you this week, Tess.
Plastics.
Ha. No. QE2.
Oh, you wanted me to make more jokes about your queen.
Oh, of course. No, we actually got a lot of reaction to our story about the second round of quantitative easing, QE2, yeah, and the Fed's plan to buy bonds. I know your favorite topic.
Yeah. Well, savers certainly are not the least bit happy about this.
Right. Here's a typical reaction we got from Mike Miller of Sylmar, California.
Although I appreciate what Mr. Bernanke is trying desperately to do, flooding the economy with $600 billion created out of thin air not only keeps interest rates absurdly low, but it also makes every dollar out there worth less. So now I'm earning pennies on a principle that's worth less. Go, Ben, go.
Mr. Bernanke, of course, being Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Of course. And, you know, I think he might, that listener, I think he's being sarcastic.
I think you're right. All right. What else?
Well, last week we started our coverage of the sandwich generation with an interview with Ron Lieber from The New York Times.
Right. This generation has come up upon even more challenges because of the recession.
Yeah, that's true. But Constance Gager wrote in from Montclair, New Jersey. She said there's another change that's making this a bigger deal these days that you guys didn't talk about.
The difference now is a combination of two demographic changes. One, women postponing childbearing, and two, increasing longevity that has led to the perfect storm known as the sandwich generation. So most people didn't face the sandwich situation until the 1980s, 1990s. Your guest addressed the living longer factor, but did not address the postponing childbearing part of the sandwich equation.
I guess we just have to do longer interviews.
I don't know if that's the solution. All right, well, let's end on a musical note. A couple of weeks ago, reporter Jeff Tyler did a piece on the fact that it's a lot harder to make it as a musician than one would think, and sometimes they have to have day jobs.
Yes.
Yes, so a couple of parents and grandparents even were grateful for the story, like Peter Fallon from Hatfield, Pennsylvania. He wrote in, said he went on our website, forwarded the story to his grandson who, quote, has a guitar growing out of his stomach and clouding his amazing mind. Hopefully this will bring some balance to his future.
Yeah, that's what we're here for, crushing your dreams.
Yeah, okay. Now, one oops on this story, though.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so more than one listener wrote in to tell us that when Jeff was talking about the Iron Maiden singer who had a second career as an airline pilot, we mistakenly played some Iron Maiden music from the wrong era of the band.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, they had a different lead singer then.
All right, who's getting fired for that offense?
Well, all I'll say on that is that the music choice was not the reporter's fault. Anyway, moving on. The lead singer who is an airline pilot is Bruce Dickinson.
All right. Well, one more from me. You know, last week we mentioned the new superhero comic book Unemployment Man. Well, we asked for some listener suggestions for other characters and got exactly one. But it's a good one. I like it. From Joe Muskowitz in Dexter, Michigan. Every hero needs a nemesis. So how about Outsourcerer? And Michigan knows from outsourcing. Thanks, Deb.
Thanks, Tess.
If you've Googled cancer, heart disease, or maybe diabetes lately, chances are you might have done it on your cell phone. And that device could help at your next doctor's visit, too.
The number of ways that we can record interesting information about ourselves, about our health, is exploding. My phone, for example, knows how much I'm running, how much I'm biking. I can even guess how much I'm sleeping based on how I use the phone.
All this week on our website, you can hear from people like Dr. Ronnie Zeiger, chief health strategist at Google. You'll also find exclusive online stories and advice from doctors. Plus, take our poll about reviewing doctors online, like they're a restaurant. Is that good for healthcare? Find it all at marketplace.org. And finally this hour, one more look at the topic of kids and money. Only this one is prepartum. We heard about this hospital in Maryland that was holding a financial planning seminar for expectant parents. And we immediately thought of reporter Nancy Marshall Genzer for the assignment. Her twin boys are 18 months old now, given that she's part of the Marketplace team. And we are all, of course, complete and total experts with our money. It's the kind of thing she would have covered a long, long time ago. Right?
When you're pregnant, you get all kinds of unsolicited advice. Let them cry it out. Pick them up before they cry. No pacifiers. Nurse them for 6 months, a year, 2 years. And whatever you do, get your financial life in order and start saving for college now. Oops. The boys are toddlers now. My husband Jan and I are decent savers, but we're even better procrastinators. We don't have a solid financial plan. So even though I'm a financial reporter, I jumped at the chance to trek out to a hospital in suburban Maryland to cover its financial planning seminar for expectant parents. Maybe I would learn something. Before things got started, I sat down with Stuart Ritter, the financial planner from T. Rowe Price, who would lead the seminar. He began with a body blow: how much it actually takes to raise a child from birth to age 17.
The total cost, according to the Department of Agriculture, is about $222,000. And not to scare you even further, but that does not include any savings for college.
Oh. Okay, Nancy can need some oxygen. Do we have that anywhere?
I recovered in time for the seminar.
Okay, each of you has a piece of paper that says prioritizing exercise.
Ritter told me and about a dozen couples to get our finances together. I was feeling guilty enough about being behind. Then I met Lannon and Duane Talafaro. She's not even pregnant yet, but here they are doing their homework ahead of time, sitting in the front row. I tried not to hate them. After the seminar, Duane told me they're both scientists and planners.
Well, I think as scientists, we're used to planning ahead and doing the research before we actually act. And so that kind of fits into who we are.
Our research falls into the realm of, hey, we're out of diapers. The seminar put me in full panic mode. Stuart Ritter had given us a checklist to take home. A grim list of obligations marches down the page. Retirement, wills, guardians for our kids, life insurance, college savings. A couple nights later, I showed the checklist to Jan, my husband. We were sitting down in the kitchen to have the talk, the one we should have had before the twins were born.
So I went to this seminar, and I got a bunch of information.
That's wonderful. Was it entertaining?
No. It was kind of scary.
I go over the checklist with Jan. First thing, retirement. Ritter says we should be sure we're saving for retirement before socking away college money. Otherwise, we'll end up broke, moving in with our kids. Ritter says it's like what flight attendants tell you. Secure your oxygen mask before helping your child. We are actually saving for retirement. I want to check that off. But Jan reminds me,
we're planning, but we don't have enough in there. We're not going to be able to live on that.
Well, at least we're doing it. At least we're saving.
No,
we're not
trying.
Right, we're trying. We're
trying.
Not saving enough, but we're trying. So I'm putting a check mark.
Is this what we can ask for a raise?
It's a good idea.
Moving right along. Life insurance is next on the list. We have some. We definitely need a lot more. As in, if you have little kids, about 10 times your salary. And assuming we don't die young and leave our sons a mountain of insurance money to pay for college, we'd better start a college savings plan. I guess. Some parents don't save anything. I kind of like the sound of that. They think the more savings, the less financial aid they'll get. Wrong. Most aid is actually loans. It's like saying you're not going to save for a car because if you do, you won't get as big a loan from the dealer. So the question now is how much to save.
So we have to decide what our priorities are and whether we want to live the good life now or do we want to save for college.
The good life? I'm happy if I have a chair. If I find a chair, it's a vacation. That's a good life.
We decide to go for broke. Literally, pouring every extra cent we have into a college fund. Here's another body blow from Stuart Ritter. 17 years from now, when our twins are heading off to school, the average private university will cost almost $96,000 a year, times two for twins. Now, we have a choice on college savings plans. We can prepay tuition, but that requires a big block of money. We opt for 529 plans, which allow you to save gradually. Sold. We're at the end of the list.
I think we're done. I feel pretty good. Do you feel pretty good?
I'm shitting.
Other than that, do you feel? I think this is good for us. We're gonna do this.
Absolutely. Let's go.
A little more enthusiasm would be nice. And I wish he'd stop talking with his mouth full. But at least we have a plan. If I ever run into those perfect pre-planning scientists again, I can be proud. Our boys couldn't care less. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time on a special broadcast from Philadelphia, healthcare is one of the most talked about, debated, mulled over issues of our time. And finally this year, a big piece of historic legislation. So how does it still wind up so intensely confusing?
You wouldn't enter the legal system without an attorney. You shouldn't enter the healthcare system without an advocate.
We'll bring you a consumer's guide to health reform. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week from chilly Philly.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return. American Public Media.